Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the OnFit Podcast ahead of the ECB. We hold these leading up before each governing council meeting to discuss the current state of play in Europe and analyse thoughts on where the ECB is. Of course, this time, the question of the day is inflation. Is it transitory or not? And what should be done about it? I'm Ellie Groves, Managing Director of the Economic and Monetary Policy Institute at OnFit. And with me today is Brigitte Granville, who is Professor of International Economics and Economic Policy in the School of Business and Management at Queen Mary University of London. She's co-director of the Centre for Globalisation Research. And very importantly for this discussion, she's author of a book, Remembering Inflation, which was from Princeton University Press in 2013. Now, very pertinent to this discussion. She also is author of What Ails France, McGill's Queen's University Press, which is May 2021. And something we will be touching on later is definitely the discussion on the French election, as it all ties into these debates. To start with, I want to put into some context. In July, the ECB updated its strategy review. Some discussed that it didn't go as far as the Fed with the flexibility of a 2% inflation target. But how are we seeing this change of strategy play out in its monetary policy decisions since July?
I think probably what we see right now is that they are starting to eat the reality. So if you are asking me about the inflation goal, let's say that of course one thing we have to remember is that price stability is of course the ECB primary objective, but it's also one of the issues they have is that some favor a very precise goal of 2%. With flexibility, while others, especially from Southern Europe, want an explicit pledge to tolerate higher rates after a period in which he has run below target. But you have quite a lot of disagreement, for instance, with Bundesbank President Jens Weidmann and the ECB Executive Board Member Isabel Schnabel, that are among those who are skeptical of such an approach. The ECB is relatively isolated in seeking inflation of less than 2%. You have to remember that there's only one other central bank of an advanced economy which basically do the same, and this is the Swiss National Bank. The ECB should really, in my view, should adopt a much simpler and much more symmetric target of 2%, making clear that undershooting the goal will lead to an equally strong reaction as overshooting. And resolving this question, of course, will influence other aspect of this review, that is, for instance, the way that inflation is measured, whether they consider house prices or not. And he will, of course, impeach on the timing of the ECB exit from the emergency measures deployed during the pandemic. And we are going to talk about that a bit later in further question. But basically, the upward revision of the to the ECB inflation projections that we are seeing over the entire forecast horizon illustrates that the bank has started to think differently about inflation. Because at the beginning, Lagarde, you know, first stressed that higher inflation was still mainly temporary, transitory. She concluded that underlying inflation pressures at edge up and that price pressure could be a bit more persistent. That's what she thought first. And so that is making its way to the official risk assessment. Having said that, the forecast are still, you know, quite surprising. I mean, there's a 1.5% core inflation forecast for 2023 and the ECB is sticking to its views that the risk of inflation being too low is clearly higher than being too high. And I think in that, in being too low, in that, it's probably, I'm not sure she's right in that.
You're not sure she's right. So, I mean, I would like to pick up on some of that. We will be also discussing the strategy review in a wider sense. But just for the moment, if you'll allow me, I want to ask if there is that expectation that inflation will be at 1.5% and continue. Actually, should the discussion be on normalizing? I mean, we can all discuss what is normal, but actually, does there need to be a further expansionary of the PPP to bring inflation to that 2% that we need? Do you think that actually we should be, that there should be a discussion on expanding the monetary policy rather than just focusing on bringing it back to normal pre-pandemic?
Lagarde essentially said policymakers need to reflect on what happens if interest rates remain low and what should be considered normal in such circumstances. And the debate really highlights how the recent rise in Eurozone inflation to its highest level for more than a decade is really creating tension between the ECB rate setters over how long the price surge is likely to last and whether the central bank should adjust monetary policy as a result. So as I said, the ECB in September forecasted that inflation would fall from an annualized rate of 2.2% in 21, 1.7% in 22, and 1.5% in 23. So I mean, to answer your question, I just think that I certainly will be in favor of a much higher inflation target at the 1.5%. But one of the difficulty, of course, as is quite obvious, you have a lot of dissent among the governing council. And I don't think that it will go very well with some of the members of this governing council.
Do you think that it would be likely? What do you think the sequencing will be? Do you think it will be likely that tapering of QE will come first, or a change to the PPP, or raising of interest rates? Which tool do you think the central bank will use first in indicating that it is responding to a high inflation?
Again, some conservative governing council members that pushed for a bigger cut in asset purchases at the central bank September meeting, and some European central bank policymakers have argued it is underestimating future inflation. And they warn about the risk of a regime shift in prices, and they pushed for a bigger cut in asset purchase that he ultimately decided at his meeting last month. But essentially, if you listen carefully to Lagarde, she has really distanced the ECB from a shift to tighter monetary policy by saying that the Eurozone there were still no signs that this increase in inflation is becoming broad-based. So she has resisted the tightening for the moment, contrary, of course, to the US or the Bank of England, as we have seen today. The problem here is that when we talk about inflation, it's very, you know, I think for some people, if you listen to Bloomberg and to the market, inflation is basically the rise of energy price. They call it an inflation. For monetary economists, this is not, it's inflationary, of course, but it's transitory because what we are not seeing a kind of wage spiral. We are not seeing a kind of the inflation spiraling up. What we are seeing is that, yes, there are some prices that are going up, but somehow, if we compare it with the situation in the 70s, central banks should be much better equipped to be able to respond to those transitory costs, if they are transitory. Now, there is also, and that will link to another question you had, and that, of course, is the interplay between the monetary and the fiscal. Mm-hmm. And there here is where, you know, everybody is a bit stuck, because it's clear that monetary and fiscal policy are basically, you know, inextricably intertwined. This started with QE. And then he went on with the pandemic, where central banks have been trying to stimulate the economy by expanding QE, and governments also, you know, like the Biden administration have done so, because they were really, the main thing they wanted to avoid is the deflationary trouble of the 2010s, time. But there is one big challenge in monetary economics, is that once you have those two policies that are completely intertwined, there is what sits at the heart of this thinking is really a government budget constraint. And if government spending stimulates demand to the extent of driving up inflation, and monetary policymakers then respond by raising interest rate, nasty surprise can ensue, in the sense that, of course, higher interest rate increase a government interest payments on its debt. And if the government responds by issuing even more debt to cover this interest payment, it can make inflation rise even faster. So in other words, government can only run so much of a deficit before some unforeseen problems crop up. And today, interest rate can no longer be a central bank first instrument of monetary policy. It's over. Public and private debt are so high that raising rate could potentially make repayment unmanageable for many. And this applies in Europe, you know, in the Eurozone, this apply in the US, this apply in the UK. So the bottom line is that public debt has expanded to the extent of essentially becoming unaffordable in a free market. And today's conundrum created by QE is just the latest demonstration of the reality that disregarded government budget constraints will result by one way or another in higher inflation. And this is a big risk. It's much more serious than energy prices, I think.
So what tools do you see central banks having if we're looking at the next sort of crisis, and it'd be, I want to hear you speak around the extending of central bank mandates to climate change and digitalization. But before I do, what do central banks have in their toolkit now? What do they still have in their toolkit?
Well, there is one big issue here. If you remember QE, when it was supposed to save the world, in 2007, was supposed to be transitory, just like inflation is supposed to be transitory right now. It was supposed to last for 6 months or so. And then financial market got completely addicted to it. Yeah. And central banks never find themselves strong enough to actually, you know, decided to cut the kind of umbilical cord. And this has got worse and worse. And now we are just reaching a point where, you know, either you go on with this system of QE, until basically crash, or you decide, you know, you, we'll have, but I don't see how they will do it. You have what we call in economics a change of regime. But this change of regime is so radical because it means that you are going to reinstate conventional monetary policy. And I bet that many people don't even remember what it is. But what is clear is that the financial market will not like it. Because, you know, Sir Matt Gaetz, he has been those years, those 10 years or 12 years for the financial market has been extremely wonderful. Not for the pensioners, not for any savers, or not for the middle class, not for the low income class, but extremely good for anybody that was in finance. And where inflation has been for 10 years, you know, a low is very funny that people start to wake. It has been on financial assets. So it's time to acknowledge it.
Would you set out from everything you've just said, are central banks operating as independent entities? Do we have, is the independence of central banks?
That is gone. That anyway, it was always okay. It was a wonderful, how could I say, you know, when New Zealand started with this thing in 1900, it was superb. Because what I like, what we all like about it, we all knew, you know, there's no such a thing as central bank independent, but at least, you know, he was putting some constraint. He was basically saying, you know, and the New Zealander did that absolutely beautifully. If the chair of the New Zealand Central Bank didn't respect his contract, he was basically fired. Yeah. Well, tries. Yeah. Try that on a French banker. I don't think that will have gone very well. But it looks like in New Zealand, it went extremely well. And that work was really a constraint. So everybody thought, okay, so it's over. The government before election or whatever is not going to call on the central bank in order to finance and to give all kind of wonderful gift to everybody in order to be elected. And therefore it's not going to create inflation, you know, is not going to have the central bank to run the campaign. And everybody was very pleased with that. Unfortunately, since 2007, it's a long time that central banks have stopped to be independent. Why? Because there were some crazy people that decided that, okay, let's have QE, because that was wonderful solution. So those are the central bank. And on the side, on the budget policy, the fiscal policy, where things should have happened, where things should have been really much looser, people, you know, in Europe decided to have austerity. And if you look at what the talk today in the UK of the Chancellor, for me, is completely surreal. I mean, we are getting out of a pandemic. And, you know, if you listen to him, he's basically decided to have another austerity plan, and you just want to say, well, sorry, just get up, awake, go to the north, go, you know, travel a bit.
Exactly. And actually, I wanted to speak on that as well around the fiscal, because obviously when COVID happened, there was a fiscal space that opened up that governments definitely filled with a lot of support measures. And as we get to the point now where we are, perceivably, you know, things are opening up. Everyone has either got bored of COVID or just pushing forward anyway.
Not bored of it. I think it's the right thing. Let's move on. Let's move on.
Wrongly or rightly, I'm not. You know, I'm sure that the NHS and healthcare system might.
Of course.
Might struggle with this, but anyway, we are. You know, at least that's the position that is being put forward. How do you see that, therefore, that this huge fiscal stimulus is going to have to be taken back, disbanded, as you said, that the UK Chancellor is already speaking on this. In Europe, you have the Next Gen EU Fund, but how far do you think the Next Gen EU Fund will be able to actually plug that? One of the things that the pandemic showed was the gap in infrastructure spending across Europe, well, across the world in lots of ways, and also the long supply chains. Macron wants to bring supply chain, you know, shorten supply chains, build for key industries, build those into France. So especially within healthcare, but obviously that takes a lot of financing, a lot of funding. And then we're not even
you know, what is extraordinary if you think about it, is that, in order to receive a diploma of economics or whatever, you have to take a PhD, yeah? In order to be a politician, anybody can decide to run. Yeah. And the problem is that, I'm very sorry, but most politicians we have right now, whether it's UK, in Europe or wherever, is that somehow they seem to have forgetting that we are entering a completely new, different phase, and that is digitalization. So there are a lot of things, you know, for instance, we can use blockchain. There are so many technology that we could use that could help actually, you know, not only it could make the life of people better, but we could actually save a lot of money as well. I'm sorry to say, but there are a lot of financial intermediaries. They know very well they are dead because with blockchain, there are many of those that will disappear, many jobs like this that will disappear. But one thing that really those politicians should focus on, and somehow, I suppose, it's because it's democratic mandate, so they're elected for 4 years or 5 years. Of course, they don't do the necessary investment for the next generation, but it's really where they should focus. Yeah. And it's not useful. It's really not useful at this time when, you know, you have the majority of the population that not only had the financial crisis in 2007 and have not recovered, but also the pandemic. And that is also going to take time to recover. So, you know, to talk again about austerity to people that can hardly cope. And, you know, I'm a liberal economist. I'm not a communist. I'm not a Marxist. I'm not even a Keynesian. So it's quite, you know, just classical economist. So I'm not one of the most radical ones. But those people really push you to think, what is this about? Yeah. And, you know, look at public servants, for instance. Their salary have not been increased since 2007. And in real terms, public servants have lost 20%. So how do you think they are going to take any more tax or talk of austerity? You must be, I mean, it's a joke.
I think that let's stay on this thinking around the French election, and it's something we spoke about while we were doing the preparation for this podcast, so just before, and we were talking around the fact that Europe will see their council presidency at the same 6 months as their presidential election, or their election. And it would be interesting to have your thoughts on the potential success of Macron, and also where we think we are in that election cycle. It's still, my interpretation is it's still a little bit too early to tell. It will depend if the Republica can set themselves with a key lightning rod figure that can unify the right, rather than Macron being splintered with, you know, challenges from a number of different people, as is often.
Okay. Sorry. So one thing you have to remember about French election, since the 70s, the candidate who is elected is never on the screen 6 months before. It's always somebody that comes. I mean, the two people that you will see in what we call the second tour, are never the one that people plan for. So Macron thought that he was going to be very easy, despite the fact that he's not like at all. He thought it will be very easy because he will do exactly like in 2017, and his opponent will be Marine Le Pen. And he will say the same, that, you know, she's a fascist, or she's not able, or put all kind of disqualification. And the French, again, will feel, well, even if they are not very happy with Macron, they will think, oh, well, given the absence of choice, we will still vote for him, and too bad. Yeah? Now, the French are not very predictable. They are violent. They also get very angry. You know, for 40 years, there are some basic issues that everybody asks them to not mention, because immediately, they will be considered right-wing or even populist or fascist or whatever. But there have been something happened that nobody planned for, and it's called Eric Zemmour. So Eric Zemmour, who is? Eric Zemmour is not as has been described in some press outside France. He's not a fascist. He's not. He's just a political commentator, and he just opened all the debate that, let's say, your average French always wonder. So what is the worry of the average French? One worry is security. It's basically all the regalian function that, as you may know, the French pay the highest tax in the world. Yeah. And now the French are just wondering, where is this money going? Since we have no safety, no security, we thought we had very good hospital and health. And now we discover that is not the case. We have discovered that during the pandemic. We thought that we had a top education system. Now we realize that we are at the bottom of the OECD PISA things. So all those things start to make people very unhappy and to ask questions. And until this guy, Eric Zemmour, came to the scene and start to open the debate and force everybody to talk about those things, Macron thought, no problem. The debate is going to be between him and Le Pen. Now, frankly, we don't know. We don't. Le Pen has less percentage vote than Zemmour. Macron seems to be stable at something like 23, but, you know, everybody's quite surprised because it doesn't move. It's about 4 months that the figure has not moved. We don't know if Barnier will be the representant of the right of the LR. So it's extremely, it's still extremely fluid right now. But that is, for Macron, is the worst scenario, because what he wanted is to make sure he destroyed the right, because the French people, majority, 70% of the French people are on the right. So he knows very well if LR managed to put a candidate, and this candidate is actually acceptable, he has no chance.
Okay. And how will that impact the European Commission and the development of the next gen EU?
Obviously, the French never voted for Maastricht. That, you know, 1992, there was a vote was 51.6. A lot of people are saying that they don't even believe that the vote was really in favor. Then, 2005, the French voted actually against, when they were asked for. They still resented, yeah, because, the French government decided, oh, okay, they didn't like that, so let's have another treaty that they call the Lisbon Treaty. Yeah. And this time, of course, they didn't have any referendum because they knew very well the French would vote no again. So they imposed it on the population. Well, the French have not forgotten that. So there is an anti-population that, yes, they like the euro because in any case, you know, every time somebody tried to talk about leaving the euro, they are, you know, they treat them of fascist or whatever. It's going to be the apocalypse. It's going to be absolutely terrible. So nobody dare discussing the euro. But more and more voice start to be very tough on the European Commission and start wondering why are those technocrats that are not elected basically start dictating their rules on the French. So it depends very much, you know, how the debate is going to go. If it goes in this direction, it's going to be a very different mandate from the one that Macron was planning to have. Because Macron is where he's going to feel stuck, because he's fundamentally, his project is completely alien to the French. His project is to, you know, when he started in 2017, he started by saying France has no culture. And the French have not forgotten that. And indeed, the French has a culture. And right now, there are many people that want to make sure that this is reclaimed. So he's going to be stuck between his desire to push France much more in a kind of federalist Europe, if you want, and wanted to be elected as president of France. And the two, unfortunately for him, they don't go really together.
I thank you for your time as well. I think that we've definitely covered a lot of ground. I want to kind of wrap up now. I think it's been an expansive conversation. I always bring in the wider geopolitical and macro considerations to where the ECB and the European Commission is obviously operating in. So the French election is key to that and will be for the next few months. But is there anything that you think that we haven't sort of covered within this? Obviously, you've got the extension of the central bank mandates to climate and digitalization, which we've not hugely touched on. But is there anything that you want to bring in specifically before we bring this very interesting discussion to a close?
Well, I think the main point, but it's really short, is a kind of opacity, really, of how the European Central Bank works, because they publish a detailed summary of the discussion in the Council and the Governing Council. But however, what is very sad is that we don't have the information on the voting process. We don't know who dissents. We don't know. So it's very opaque. It's not transparent. And that really contrasts with the Fed and with the Bank of England. And of course, I think all the watchers understand that with regard to the ECB is much more complicated because there are so many participants. And many country representatives. But still, that will be a really source of progress. People, they should understand that with transparency, people may have much more confidence in the ECB than without it.
Thank you very much. And that circles us back to actually the beginning conversation in many ways around the toolkit that the ECB has at its disposal and the confidence that people put into monetary policy within the markets, but also citizens. So which is a whole other conversation, which I'm sure we can delve into as well at another time.
Maybe but, not today.
Exactly. Well, it's a whole other topic of conversation. So thank you very much for joining us. Thank you to the listeners.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFIF podcast.